Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. If you take a closer look at some of the language we use to describe food and health, you'll find much in common. For example, the words hospitality and hospital come from the same Latin word, hospes, which meant a place for strangers to find protection and comfort in ancient times. And as restaurateur Joanne Clevenger will tell you, the root word for restaurant translates from French to English as restore. On this week's show, we're looking at individuals who are doing their part to make the world a better place through food and drink. We begin with entrepreneur Joanne Clevenger of the Upper Line Restaurant. While she's most famous for her uptown restaurant, Joanne has worn many different hats over her lifetime, managing multiple businesses while always emphasizing hospitality. We hear her story, then we'll talk culinary medicine with three doctors who combine nutrition and culinary knowledge to help their patients get and remain healthy. Finally, we'll hear from a most unusual cocktail enthusiast, ordained Catholic priest, Father Bill Daly, who gives us a spiritual look at bar culture. We're restoring our mind, body, and soul on this week's Louisiana Eats.
This is Joanne Clevenger. I'm the owner and sort of general manager of the Upper Line Restaurant here in New Orleans. I opened in January 1983, and I'm really proud to still be around.
To the New Orleans community, Joanne Clevenger is much more than a restaurateur. She's a local fixture and a living legend. In 2015, the Southern Foodways Alliance honored her with the Craig Claiborne Lifetime Achievement Award for her community stewardship and contributions to the hospitality industry. But her remarkable career didn't begin in food. Here, Joanne shares stories of a journey twisted and turned through multiple incarnations before she established the Upper Line in 1983. Joanne, you are such an amazing woman. It's very hard for me to know where to begin. But let's begin with the fact that you are not a native New Orleanian.
That's right, Puppy. I am Louisiana. I really am Louisiana. I was really influenced in food by my grandfather and my grandmother. I was born in Alexandria, Louisiana, and my father hunted and fished, and we ate what he caught and what he shot. My grandfather, my most vivid memory, is a mule and a plow. But we had good food, and it was well prepared.
Joanne, I think a lot of people, of course, they know you as the great restaurateur of the Upper Line Restaurant, but you have had so many different careers besides restaurateur that you seem to be a cat with more than nine lives.
I'm just really lucky. And you know, part of my luck, a big part of my luck, is being born to a family that love to take books and food and going to good public schools, but being raised in North Louisiana with that Protestant work ethic and always show up for the meeting. You come to the Big Easy and you always show up for the meeting on time. You get to do things.
You get to do things.
So I got a job and I moved to French Quarter and I met a great group of interesting people, married an intellectual French Quarter bohemian who had many friends who were artists and chefs and writers, and had two little children, was very poor, like I was when I was growing up. In my 20s, I was a waitress and helped manage a restaurant on Bourbon Street. That's how I learned about restaurants. And then I opened a little folk music bar next to your father's mustache while I kept my job at Rizzo's Italian restaurant. And Joni Mitchell came in once and sang for us. Joe Cocker filmed part of his movie, Mad Dogs and Englishmen, in there. When Richie Havens was in town, he would come in and sing for us, Here Comes the Sun. And while I was there, I started a little flower cart business. And the state sued me.
Yes, the flower cart business caused you to revolutionize the cut flower business in Louisiana.
Because the laws that had been passed in the early 60s made it very difficult to sell even a single daisy or carnation. And the judge let me bring the flower cart up to the bench, and he declared the law to be arbitrary and capricious. But that only found for me, actually. It didn't apply to other people similarly situated. So I got on my high horse, and I helped write legislation creating something called Cut Flower Dealer, and I lobbied it through Baton Rouge. I put a flower, a carnation, on every legislator's desk. I took my two children and the flower cart to Baton Rouge. The newspapers and the TV took it up as Mom, Apple Pie, and Flower Girls. We won. It created something that made it possible to buy a single flower or a bunch of flowers without having elaborate apprenticeship, without taking an elaborate test to show your ability to make a funeral wreath. I'm really proud of that because I think it brought flowers in an easy way for many, many people all over Louisiana.
You couldn't walk into a grocery store today and buy a bouquet of flowers if it weren't for Joanne Clevenger.
Well, somebody else might have done it later, but yes, that's right.
Come on down to the Mermaid Cafe and I will buy you a bottle of wine.
I opened Andy's. That was a little folk music bar. But I couldn't make any money because the rent was so high, so I couldn't quit my job. So I decided to open another bar where the rent wasn't so high. And I found a place on Decatur Street, and the rent was only $300 as opposed to $1,000. And I bought the lease from an ex-Filipino yo-yo champion.
You're making that up.
No, he used to yo-yo up and down the sidewalk in front, but not enough people came. So I bought his lease. And my husband, Max Clevenger, helped me to put all this stained glass in there. And I built the back bar, and we called it the Abbey. And the way that people thought I was nuts, because Decatur Street was pretty sleazeville then.
No man's land.
That's right. It really was. And I brought in Guinness on tap, which no one in Southeast United States had done. I had to pay for the storage. But the big thing was I brought in the New York Times on Sundays. You used to have to wait till Tuesday to get your Sunday paper. And so every Sunday morning, I'd drive to the airport, pick up the bundle of papers they'd put on the plane, go to Bill Long's to get bread and cheese, and bring it all back to Decatur Street. And I had the most amazing, eclectic group of people, including Turner Catledge, who had been the managing editor of the Times, and Mrs. Stern from Longview Gardens, and the Times-Picayune people, and Mayor Dutch Morial. So it was just this eclectic, amazing bar crowd. And then I decided to get out of bars and restaurants, and I opened a vintage clothing store, and I was splitting up with my husband at the time, so he took the Abbey, and I took my little flower carts down the next block of Decatur Street, and I opened a vintage clothing store and kept doing the flowers for a little while. And one of my first customers that first couple of months was Paul McCartney and his wife.
Oh, that was rough.
They used to stay at the Richelieu, which was down there around the corner. It was a day where it wasn't very busy, and they were just looking for ties. Old ties. And they bought some ties. I said, "Ooh, I like this. This is great."
It's pretty exciting. Brings a beetle in.
I love the search for it. My mother took in sewing when I was growing up. And I love fabric. I love the hunt for treasure. Old clothes that other people had treasured enough to save. And I felt like I was rescuing their treasures. And then washing them and ironing them. And then someone else come along and put more love into it. And so it was a very lovely, what I call a benevolent circle. But the crazy thing about the old clothes store was that I inadvertently became a costume designer. Fernell Bonnerice wrote a show called One More Time. And where I went for breakfast every day, Vaucresson Creole Cafe, he was my waiter. And he got all the performers, the band, the sound guy to work for free. And he came to my shop and asked me if I'd help him with the costumes. I said, "Vernell, I don't know how to do that." He said, "I'll help you." I said, "Okay." So we put on a play, right? At one point, we had 5 casts around the world.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. It was an incredible learning curve for me. I got to see the Queen in London shake hands with the New Orleans cast while they were wearing my costumes.
Incredible.
And I did get good reviews.
So there you are in your vintage clothing store, happy as a clam.
Yeah, I was actually.
And a building uptown comes up for sale. What possessed you to change course again?
I was looking for a way to open a second store near the universities. And I was driving past Kirsch's Jeans Barbecue Restaurant on my way back to the quarter, and it said, for a lease. So I called when I got back to the quarter, and the lady said, oh, it's no longer for lease. Today, the owners decided to sell the building. And all the years I've been this serial entrepreneur, I never could afford a building. And the first thought when she said it was for sale was, how much? So I said, how much?
That's great bargaining power.
And it was just a little tiny first room you come in. It was $112,000. And the first thought that went through my brain was, I think I could do that.
Oh, gosh.
And I got so excited, I couldn't remember the word option. So I had this long, convoluted question about, whereby if I gave you a certain amount of money, would you promise not to sell it to anybody?
Oh.
So I persuaded my husband, that's my second husband, Alan Greenacre, to take a second mortgage on our house. He's an engineer. I persuaded my son, Jason Clevenger, to quit his job as a head chef at Cafe Sabiza's. We bought the building. We did the work. We cleaned it all out. And we opened January 83 with 40 chairs and no money for the first week's payroll.
When we come back from a short break, Joanne Clevenger tells us of her journey to become the restaurateur and hospitality leader she is today. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Ralph's on the Park, featuring Chef Chip Flanagan's globally influenced New Orleans cuisine overlooking City Park. Lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch, and private events at 900 City Park Avenue in New Orleans Mid-City. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Joanne Clevenger, whose journey to become owner of the Upper Line in 1983 took her down many paths. We continue as she opens her new business.
Of course, there were very few uptown restaurants then, and so we got a nice honeymoon, and it was exciting. My son was very well organized. He got us in Gourmet Magazine. But you know how we got in Gourmet Magazine?
How?
Ella Brennan brought Ellen Brown to lunch, and Ellen Brown was doing a story about New Orleans restaurants, and she included Commanders and us, and I think the other one might have been Bayona. So, I mean, I owe so much to Ellen, not just for that particular instance, but the inspiration that she and other restaurant tours and chefs, women, have started a path that the rest of us can follow without as many obstacles as they had. When we first opened, we had a charcoal grill. There were very few restaurants. Jason had put in a charcoal grill at Sabiza's before he left, and we had one, so we did grilled fish, which was very new on charcoal in New Orleans at that time. When I looked at a menu today from when we first opened, and some of the dishes we still have on the menu are there. They've evolved. We had a shrimp remoulade then. We have a shrimp remoulade now. But we put it on top of the fried green tomatoes. We had roast duck on our menu. And it's evolved. I've had 6 main chefs, and each of them is reflected on today's menu. And I'm really proud of that it's a collaborative effort. It's not one person that's driven this engine. It's a collaboration. The front of the house, the back of the house, all 6 of these chefs of course, the guests and their feedback and the media and the vendors, but it's not a single entity, not a single person that does it. It's a collaborative effort.
You really are the restaurant, Joanne. When people go to the Upper Line, if you were to not be there, I think they might just about fall down.
Well, I'm pretty consistent. I am. I think that's, again, that North Louisiana work ethic. But part of it also is being a waitress and learning to come out of myself, because before that I was a bookworm. And if you're a waiter or waitress, you have to become gregarious. You have to look at the guest as someone you want to enhance their experience. And when I finally found out about 25 years ago the original meaning of the word restaurant, restorative, I was so relieved because it made sense, the whole thing. Again, it's a benevolent circle. We restore the guest, whether it's a diner or a hot dog stand or haute cuisine. If you do it right, your guests come in after the hassles of the day and you nourish them in spirit and body, and they go away stronger, braver, and enhanced. And that's a restorative. Because I guess, Poppy, in some ways, I want the world to be a better place. And I'm not a school teacher, and I'm not a registered nurse or doctor. But in my own little way, I can help people to feel better about their lives for a little while and feel nurtured and celebratory. Because restaurants celebrate life. They celebrate the occasion. They make occasions more memorable because of the hospitality and because of the shared experience. Sometimes I talk about restaurants are about strangers breaking bread together. And I think it makes us more tolerant of each other. And I think in the long run, it makes us more appreciative of our lives. And sometimes we forget that our lives are not a dress rehearsal. So I really think we should grab the day, live for today, and be of some good in the world.
With your over 30 years in the business now, Joanne, what do you hope that your legacy in this industry will be?
That the people that work with us over the years go on to have it make a difference in their lives. Because that's the other part of having a restaurant. You hire people, and sometimes you can nurture them into a place where they want to go. They didn't even realize they wanted to go. Our bartender has been with us over 20 years. African-American, he started as a dishwasher when he was a junior in high school. He was the most shy person I had ever met. And he has thrived and flourished, and he's an amazing bartender. And when we go out of town for holidays, he's the one who has to come. And if the burglar alarm goes off, he's the one who comes over. You know, I mean, we've been a niche for people. We had Ken Smith worked for us for 20 years, 10 years learning to be a chef, 10 years as our chef. He left us 6 years ago to learn to be a Roman Catholic priest. At the age of 50, he left us. So it was a collaborative effort. We nurtured him, he nurtured us, but it was a niche for him before he went out into this other adventure in life. And so I think the legacy I want to think about is, what have we done for the people that work with us, and maybe also what have we done for the people who are our guests and our customers? Because I know that we have a place in their hearts, and for some of them, because they'll come back and they haven't been in 20 years. And they say, oh, I'm so glad to see you. I was hoping so much you would be here. And so we have a place in other people's spirits and hearts. And that's good to know.
But Joanne, I'm so grateful that you took this time to sit down with us. And thank you so much for being our guest on Louisiana Eats and sharing your amazing story with us.
I'm a lucky person. I'm such a lucky person. Thank you, Poppy. It was a lovely thing to be with you.
Joanne Clevenger of the Upper Line Restaurant.
Happiness, more or less, it's just a change in me, something in my liberty, on my mind. Happiness coming and going.
The ancient Greek physician Hippocrates said, "Let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food." It's good advice. But for too long, our society has been consuming processed meals with artificial preservatives and additives, leading to a number of health problems. To combat this, a new movement has been taking place called culinary medicine. It arms doctors with scientifically based information to help their patients start and maintain a healthier diet. One way is to harness the power of spices. To get a better understanding of culinary medicine, we sat down with Natasha McAller, author of Spice Health Heroes, and met two of those heroes, Dr. Geeta Maker-Clark and Dr. Linda Hsu. Well, I am thrilled to have you ladies all together in the studio. So, welcome. Tell me a little bit about your work and what you all do.
I'm Natasha McAller. I'm a chef and a culinary consultant and a cookbook author.
I'm Dr. Linda Hsu. I'm an internal medicine doctor and a trained chef, and I also teach cooking classes to patients and the community. So primarily, I see patients in primary care, but I've always loved food. That was probably my earliest love from childhood. 10 years into my practice, I felt like I was getting a little burned out, and I went to a conference that combined my interests. It was about food and medicine. And then I decided at that time that I would do that, both for my patients to offer them something new and for myself to reinvigorate my practice.
My name is Dr. Geeta Maker-Clark. I'm a family physician. I specialize in integrative medicine. So I am also a primary care physician. I found myself from a very young age always being very interested in beyond just what the story was in front of me of what was happening with the physical body, which is what medical school training really does focus on. But growing up in an Indian family, you know, food is treated as a medicine, and that was how I was raised from a very early age. So I found the dichotomy of learning about human health without ever discussing food or spirituality to be very odd. And when I ended up out in the world and working mostly with migrant farm workers who are under a great deal of stress and also dealing with a lot of malnutrition, it felt like the right thing to do was to start to bring that interest back into the patient-doctor interaction. So like Linda, I just started having those conversations that really focused around food first, not as the last question when they're walking out the door, but the first question, and treating food as the first medicine before we talked about dosage changes or anything else.
Well, it is kind of interesting because we all have to eat to live.
Right.
And so it seems that you should just automatically have that connection made for you as a doctor. But doctors seem to be far more interested in pills than vegetables.
I think that's how we're trained. It's changing a little bit now, you know, thanks to, you know, this work that we're all interested in, and we're still a small minority of the medical profession. But I think it's actually going back to the oldest medicine. And again, really satisfying, I think, for the doctors who are involved in it. But also, I think for patients, it's just, you know, food is common ground, right? We all eat, we all love food. And so I think even more than just talking about it from a health perspective, it's a way of connecting with people. That's what I love about it.
Your collaboration really came about through the work that you did with Natasha on her book, Spice Health Heroes. Why do you all believe that spices are one of the strongest medicines in our pantry?
I mean, they were originally the first medicines that we had. You know, many medications are still derived from spices. But also for me, in talking about food with patients and cooking, it's a great way to get people to eat better in more healthy ways with maybe less salt and less fat and less sugar as the only ingredients that they use to season, with a whole world of spices. You know, you basically bring the whole world to you through your spice cabinet. It is both the medicine that we had in many of the earliest medical traditions and a great way to introduce cooking. So that's why I love it.
The other piece too, you know, about spices is that they are so richly medicinal. If you look back at these ancient, you know, recipes from every ancient wisdom culture, you find that these are not coincidental uses of spices. You know, you'll have a meat prepared with something that helps cure it and preserve it and help you digest it. And these rich layerings of flavors absolutely, you know, they don't just lighten and brighten the food, but they help you digest it and make the nutrients bioavailable. So we're just now starting to realize how smart our ancestors were when it comes to spices. You know, like these are the blends they put together taste amazing, but they do amazing things in the body.
Give me some specific examples.
One of my favorites is turmeric, and now turmeric is kind of like the new cool thing. But turmeric's been around for thousands of years, especially in India. We use it in everything. We start our spice blends usually with turmeric and black pepper. And so now we know scientifically that black pepper improves the absorption of turmeric, and turmeric is a very strong anti-inflammatory, particularly for the gut lining. And we use it often for gut inflammation. So, you know, that was kind of an interesting piece for me to realize that, whoa, these two things that I've been eating since I was a kid and, you know, been in my family forever are actually, you know, a perfect pairing for curing inflammation in the gut.
Yeah, my family background, my family's from Taiwan. There's always been a little bit from traditional Chinese medicine, although not specifically. And this is the kind of interesting thing where, you know, a lot of these are traditions passed down through cultures without any book knowledge necessarily. And so I guess one of the primary flavors in a lot of Chinese food is ginger, which, you know, can be used and is used still a lot in food, but also as an anti-nausea agent, both for seasickness and during pregnancy, for example.
I've discovered so many things about spices, studying the history and the myths and the fascinating stories and how wars were won and lost because of spices, because of a simple peppercorn or a clove.
Right.
It's extraordinary the power of it. And now they're so easily available either in your local shop or community market, or some things can be grown depending on where you live. Bay leaves, for instance, can be grown just about anywhere, and rosemary and spices like that. But the fact that it's, they're so available, and they do give so much more flavor as well as the nutrients to the food, and they're so easy to make and they don't cost very much.
Mm-hmm. Natasha McAller and Drs. Geeta Maker-Clark and Linda Hsu. Dr. John J. Hutchings is a gastroenterology doctor practicing medicine in New Orleans. He's also a psychiatrist, which gives him a unique perspective on how emotional health and eating habits can overlap to affect the GI tract.
When I started out in medical school, I initially wanted to be a psychiatrist, and one of the things that I noticed was that a lot of people in psychiatry have a lot of medical problems that will interact with their psychiatric illness and vice versa. So I wanted to make sure that I had the medical background to treat my patients well in psychiatry. And what I found was that neither one of those is inseparable from the other, that to really be a well-rounded physician, a well-rounded psychiatrist, it was important to have a strong foundation in both. And when I finished my medical school, I wanted to do training in a position where I could continue learning about both fields. So I did a combined residency at Tulane University. That's what brought me here to New Orleans in medicine and psychiatry. And that allowed me, it really opened up the world to me to what I wanted to do. It gave me an opportunity to do many different things. And what I decided to do was try to find a field where I could practice both. And with that, I learned that gastroenterology, a lot of people express their emotional distress through their bowels. And I had the opportunity to do something innovative here and try to treat people more holistically. Now, that sometimes has a bad connotation to it in modern Western medicine, but honestly, the truth of the matter is that people, you can't separate their organ systems. Now, we can think about things separately, but really, when you're dealing with someone, it is a complete package, and you have to think about all the different components that make up a person.
So you get references from other gastroenterologists?
I do indeed. I get from around the region, patients get sent to me with often with combined problems. So they've had a very comprehensive workup. They've had multiple endoscopies where someone has looked into their GI tract with a camera, or they've had multiple different imaging studies like a CT scan or an MRI, or they've been to emergency rooms in different hospitals all around the region, and people throw their hands up and go, well, you know, we can't find anything structurally wrong with you, so we're not sure exactly what to do. So some people are reluctant to come to see a psychiatrist, but when they come to see me as a gastroenterologist, they don't realize that they're also getting that secondary evaluation. And we broach that topic over the time that we meet with one another. I'm very fortunate in the setting I have at LSU that I am given the time to meet with patients. So when they come to see me, they actually get to see me for an hour. And so we start from the beginning. I try to figure out when the problem started, what's been going on, and then we start talking about what could be contributing to some of the physical stuff that you're having. And a majority of those patients, we start to uncover that there's some emotional stress that goes along and can be impacting their physical state. And then they start to realize that, you know, maybe there is some things that I can do differently that will have a positive impact on my physical nature.
Give me some examples of problems that have presented themselves and how you came up with the cure.
Well, people will come to me with unexplained abdominal pain. So they can't figure out why they're having problems with their bowels. So either that's nausea or vomiting or other issues like having trouble going to the bathroom, either one way or the other. And those patients attribute that all to physical problems with their bowels. And what I try to do with them is talk to them about what's happening with their GI tract. And one of the things that we talk about is that, you know, there's more innervation in the GI tract for receptors that people associate with depression, then those are serotonergic receptors. Those receptors are found in the GI tract. So the other interesting thing that I explain to patients is that the nervous system of the GI system is completely independent of the central nervous system. If I were to take your GI tract out and throw it on the table and give it a blood supply and give it the right amount of nutrients, it could go on functioning forever. So that means that with that nervous system and your central nervous system, there is the necessity of the two systems to talk to one another. And with certain patients, particularly patients with functional GI disorders, such as IBS, that's kind of the flagship one, the nervous systems are not talking to one another.
And what's the cure? How do they set out to get better?
Well, unfortunately, there's no magic bullet, but there are some different things that you can do to help patients improve those GI problems. Exercise is a big one. You know, exercise is very important. Having an active physical activity. I also believe that sleep is nature's antidepressant, anti-anxiety, which has a positive influence on your overall well-being as well. And finally, there's diet, and diet is extremely important, particularly with patients with functional GI disorders.
So you've got someone who is perhaps depressed, anxious, you know, very common symptoms in the 21st century, in the crazy world that we live in. Are there specific things that you would urge them to consume or not to consume?
Great question. So let's take a step back and talk about how we get to what's important with nutrition. There's an emerging field investigating the microbiome, which is kind of a fancy word for the bacteria that live in your GI tract. And this emerging area of science has proven that the bacteria that is living in your GI tract can have a substantial impact on how your GI tract functions, on how you feel, the amount of abdominal pain that you have, bloating, and those sorts of things. So with that, the diet can be influenced by what you eat. So some of the things that are currently being investigated are over-the-counter supplements such as probiotics. You can find those in nutritional stores or in grocery stores, and those are having have been proven to have some impact on the GI tract. Now, there's not a lot of absolute science showing that it may do a tremendous amount of noticeable changes for a lot of people, but for some people in the right patient population, it's probably a good idea to at least consider with your healthcare provider.
Dr. John J. Hutchings, practicing gastroenterologist and psychiatrist in New Orleans. Is salt a spice or a seasoning? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. Is salt a spice or a seasoning? Actually, it's neither. Salt is a mineral. Just check the periodic table. And it's very, very different from everything else in your spice cabinet and pantry. For one thing, it doesn't lose its flavor with age. It's a remarkable standalone ingredient that has had a tremendous impact on human history. There are two kinds of culinary salts, sea salt and mined salt, but all salt begins with seawater. Sea salt is evaporated from salty waters, while mined salt comes from ancient deposits left by seas dried up long, long ago. So bless the cook and pass the salt. Or just bless the salt. Life without it would be very, very bland indeed. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
I am Father Bill Daly of the Congregation of Holy Cross, which is a group of priests founded in France in the 19th century and in the United States, primarily known for having founded the University of Notre Dame. I teach in the law school there, and I am the rector of an undergraduate residence hall.
Father Bill Daly is no ordinary priest. Aside from his law degree and tenured position as Notre Dame professor, Father Bill finds himself in the unique position of being the esteemed clergyman to a community of craft cocktail innovators. With his singular perspective on the connection between spirituality and spirits, Father Daly has become the moral backbone of the Apprentice or CAP program at Tales of the Cocktail in New Orleans. We were graced with the opportunity to sit down with Father Bill during Tales of the Cocktail to discuss living a virtuous life behind the bar. Father Bill, we're so happy to have this opportunity to speak with you on Louisiana Eats. How in the world do you come to be involved with Tales of the Cocktail, and how did you get chosen to be in the Cocktail Apprentice program?
I often say that if I am not the luckiest person in the world, I can't wait to meet who is, because they must have really great stories to tell. But mine has some logic to it. So I teach in the law school at Notre Dame, and to teach in a law school, my view is you should practice law. So I went to law school as a priest in order to get ready to do some work teaching or administrating at the University of Notre Dame. And after law school, I clerked for a federal judge. Then I practiced at a regular big corporate law firm in Washington, D.C. for a couple of years, where I met a fellow named Derek Brown. His girlfriend at the time had a bar called the Tabard Inn, where she made beautiful craft cocktails on Wednesday and Thursday nights. I was introduced to this place and to Chantal by a colleague of mine at the law firm. Derek came in one night and said, "Chantal tells me you're a priest. I would like to finish my Catholic initiation. Can you help me?" So on Sunday mornings, Derek would come to my parish. I would talk over then Father Ratzinger's book, Introduction to Christianity, written back in 1967, I think. We would chat about the Catholic faith, and he would say, "Hey, I'm opening this speakeasy tonight. You should come by." Or a group of us are planning a repeal day party in December. Would you be on the planning committee with us? Or we elected you chaplain to the D.C. Craft Cocktail Bartender Association. I said, "What are my duties?" "Well, as far as I could tell, you keep coming to our bars and we charge you less." It seemed like a good deal to me. So I joke with Derek that I tried to save his soul and he has tried to destroy my liver. May one of us succeed. Hopefully the right one.
That's something. So you get this induction into the craft cocktail world by just showing up.
That's
by
right.
Just being there. And when did you first hear about Tales of the Cocktail and this opportunity?
When I moved to Notre Dame in South Bend, you might imagine that there are fewer craft cocktail bars in South Bend,
yes.
And you would not be wrong. And so I didn't get to see my friends nearly as much. So once again, through the good offices of Derek Brown, he called me up. He said, you know, we need to find a way to get you to Tales of the Cocktail. So we conspired to put together a panel for 2012 Tales called The Spirit of Spirits. And we talked about the intersection of religion and alcohol, which, as I'm sure you would imagine, goes back to as early as there was alcohol. There was religion and there was alcohol. And as the psalm says in Psalm 104, he gives us wine to gladden our hearts. And so that has always brought people closer to God. And we did a panel about that. It was reasonably well received. And my friend Don Lee said, you know, I think it would be good for the CAP program if you would come and hang out with us. And that's not an offer you turn down. So
no.
Mostly my job is to be present to them. You know, a priest and a bartender both share what we call in the caring professions, right? And so these hospitality professionals care for their guests and they care for one another in a way that is impressive and moving to me. And I suppose there's a kind of symbiosis in these friendships where they help me to be a better priest. And I hope at least at the margins, I can help them to think about hospitality a little bit differently.
I am really, really so impressed by this because I'll be honest with you, Father Bill, the CAPS program was the last place in the world I expected to find a priest because when I usually hear about what the CAPS are up to, it's usually more about drunken debacles and sexcapades. And so I was thinking, well, how does Father Bill fit into that scene? It goes all night. It's kind of wild. Do you ever find their behaviors self-conscious in any way because suddenly they're hanging with a priest?
I hope they're not self-conscious. And just in my experience, they are not. I would say that while I have heard those same stories, for the most part, and certainly right up front, they're presented to me as a priest. I wear my Roman collar on the first day when they're presented with their jackets, the red coats as the new caps. There's a PowerPoint presentation. It says if you need help or advice in the kitchen, you go to Mike Ryan, who wears a white coat. If you need help with overall logistics, you go to Don Lee, who wears a white coat. If you need to know what's going on in the liquor room, you go to Chris DeLavi, who wears a white coat. And if you're having trouble with your roommate, if you're not sleeping well, if you overindulged, you can talk to Father Bill. And
oh, so that's wonderful.
They present me as someone that they have brought in because they care about the human dimension of folks. And they want people to be responsible and to take care of themselves. And so I think there has been a move with Tales growing and becoming so important to the industry to emphasize not just the wilder side of things, but also balance and the idea, as Robert Simonson from the New York Times, I brought him out to talk to my undergraduates at Notre Dame about virtue and alcohol. And he said to them that his mother, who just died last year, drank an old-fashioned every day, and Robert, in her honor, drinks one every Friday, and he wants to do that when he's 65 and 75 and 85, should he make it there. And so I think there's an emphasis now in the CAP program to make sure that these folks can sustain a career for the long haul. And that has to do with a little less debaucherousness, I suppose. If I heard confessions, I couldn't tell you. But I have neither been a part of nor witnessed any sexcapades. That's all I can tell you on that score. I joke sometimes with my fellow priests at Notre Dame who aren't quite sure what I'm coming down here for, that it's my flock of 20-something tattooed pagans. But they welcome me, and, you know, I'm not down here. I tell them at the beginning, if I can be supportive of them, if I can walk through this with them, that's great. I am not here to sell them Bibles or give them away, and I'm not here to convert people in any way other than what Pope Francis says, which is that if I live the joy of the gospel, then I'm doing the priesthood right. The point of it is not evangelization. It's walking with people.
So. I appreciate that. That's just remarkable. I know that one of your particular bents is people's ethical behavior. Could you tell me a little bit about how you regard the ethical responsibility of both the bartender and the cocktail drinker?
Sure. I'll tell you what I tell my students, right? So I deal with students from the age of 18 to 22 at Notre Dame, and as you might imagine, not all of them respect the law of the state of Indiana, which says that they need to be 21 when they drink. And as you might imagine, the 18 and 19-year-old and 20-year-old drinkers that I sometimes have to help to see some light, they don't have very good taste in booze either. So I tell them that their taste and their maturity need to grow swiftly, right? You need to think about who you want to be at midnight and plan to be that person. And if what you want to be at midnight is not someone you'd be proud to be, well, that's when you go out and buy a plastic bottle of something that doesn't taste very good and down as much of it as quickly as you can, hiding it with things that taste better to you than whatever's in that plastic bottle. That is the misuse and the abuse of alcohol to lead you away from who you want to be as your best self, right? Wine that gladdens the heart is, you know, a cocktail shared with friends that certainly warms the spirit. I'm not saying there's no effect of alcohol on the system, right? And that's a part of what is good about it when it's used responsibly to build friendship, to build community. So I try to get people to think about that.
Father Bill, give us an overview of how you see spirits and spirituality going hand in hand.
Well, there were two points we tried to make in a panel that we did on that I mentioned earlier. Derek Brown and Eric Seed and some of the other presenters talked about the history from the earliest times, people who believed in God, one God or another, and who discovered that that fruit rotting over in the corner actually was fermenting and that there was something profound, something that warmed the heart about that alcohol. It began to be incorporated into religious rituals. It's not accidental that wine is the first miracle in the Gospel of John. There was something that warmed the heart at that wedding at Cana, and that was a foreshadowing of what for Catholics and other Christians is the Eucharist, right? Communion, bread, and wine. My contribution to that panel was to think more broadly about hospitality. And what I tried to make was the following point, which is think about why people come into a church. They've moved to a new town and they want community. They come to a church because someone has died and they want consolation. They come to a church because they've gotten engaged and they want to celebrate and solemnize what they've just done and plan for a wedding. They come to a church because they're feeling lost. Why do people show up at a bar in some city they may not have lived in? They want to find community and communion. They may have had a bad day and they need some consolation. They may have gotten a scary medical result. They may have just gotten engaged and they want to go celebrate and buy everyone a round of bubbles. Precisely the same things that bring people into a church and into my line of work bring people into a bar seeking hospitality. And what a bartender does, what a priest does when we are doing our jobs well, is to create a space for people who are hurting, who are lonely, who are celebrating, and that's a ministry of hospitality. And so I think, as I said earlier, it's fair to say that there is a commonality of professions between these bartenders and myself, and they are caring professions at their very best, and they help people to feel a little bit more comfortable in the world.
Father Bill Daly of the Congregation of Holy Cross. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, author Andrew Lawler gives us an answer to the question, why did the chicken cross the world?
I was dragged kicking and screaming into this topic because I didn't know much about chickens, but I've discovered that there are a wonderful way to learn about who we are as a people. That where humans and civilization go, there goes the chicken.
Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. If you love Louisiana Eats, let others know and help like-minded Louisiana food lovers find our show by leaving a review on iTunes. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from Tableau, Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant serving local Creole cuisine with a view of Jackson Square. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eat studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook as well. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.